When it comes to a family car, it has to be refined, beautifully designed, as well as being comfortable to drive.
But a car needs to be fun to drive, responsive and sporty. I don't want a boring car just because I've got a family.
But it should ooze class and make you feel $1 million when you get in.
Ah, but it shouldn't cost $1 million. It needs to be affordable, with 0% APR representative, a £750 deposit from Mazda, and no minimum customer deposit.
It's got to be the Mazda 3. Exactly.
Funny, I was thinking the same thing.
For more information, search Mazda 3 or visit your local Mazda dealer. Mazda personal contract purchase, T's and C's apply. Finance subject to status, 18s or over. Guarantee may be required. Mazda Financial Services excludes Sport Black models.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Tristan Riddell.
I'm Matt Hansen.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
All right, this is episode 6, and today we are talking about remakes. That's right, remakes. Movies that have existed in another form on film. But before we get into that, we have a superhero intro. We have a couple of things to talk about in the superhero realm. And Matt, you and I are big superhero fans.
Yes, I think it's safe to say that for sure.
I mean, right now, as we're recording this, I'm wearing a Batman t-shirt, and what I want to talk about is the new Batmobile. So we've gotten teaser pics from Zack Snyder on Twitter and online and everything like that of like the back of the Batmobile and then like the side of the Batmobile. But now we have a full-blown picture of the front and the side. We now know what it looks like from all angles, and I don't know how I feel about it. I thought that we were going to get much more of a retro look to the Batmobile, kind of go back to the 80s with Michael Keaton, just because this story is based off of, you know, something that, like a comic book that was made in the 80s.
Right. To me, I'm not very familiar with the Batverse. We tend to like superheroes, Tristan, but you're the much more DC guy. I'm the Marvel guy.
Yes, that's very true.
So, to me, just from the Marvel outsider look, it looks like Zack Snyder threw the Burton Batmobile and the Bale Batmobile into a blender, and this is what came out.
I think that is a perfect description of this Batmobile. It is very much a mix between Michael Keaton's Batmobile, you know, Tim Burton, as you said, and the Tumbler. It's like if the two of them had a baby, this is what it would look like. And I guess I should be happy about that because it's a blend of the two and I love both. But at the same time, I'm kind of like, pick one or the other. And I don't know, at least it's not like a literal tank that was actually used in The Dark Knight Returns, the comic book, Frank Miller's comic book, which is, I think, the relationship between Superman and Batman in this movie is loosely based off of.
Right. I have another question for you as the supreme Batman fan of the podcast. Now, from what I understood of hearing in Batman lore, I thought Batman didn't use guns. Now, does the Batmobile always have guns on it? Because, like, it has these two big machine guns, this Snydermobile on the front.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Like that. Okay. That has gotten a lot of press, and a lot of articles have been written about how, oh, hey, you know, like this Batmobile has guns mounted on the front. And what about, you know, Batman's no guns rules? And now,
I couldn't remember. Did the old Batmobiles have guns on them or weapons on them of any kind?
Now, if you go back to the TV series, I don't think that had any guns on it. Now, in 1989, with Tim Burton and Michael Keaton, that had guns on it. The Batman Forever one had guns on it. Actually, I don't know if that one had guns on it. I don't think we ever saw it in use. But anyway, in 1989 with Michael Keaton, it had guns on it. Like this is not the first time that the Batmobile has had guns on it. And then you have the Tumbler, which, I mean, it might not have had, you know, guns with bullets on it, but it had the Batpod within it that had guns on it. And so we, you know, in every iteration, we've seen a vehicle owned by Batman with guns on it. So this is nothing new. I mean, yeah, like, but the thing is, you know, like Batman has a no guns rule, as in for his person, like he doesn't use guns hand-to-hand or to kill anybody or to maim anybody, but he'll use it on a vehicle to blast open a door or disable another car because it just makes sense.
I have, you know, I compare because my only exposure to Batman really has been the movies that I've seen, you know, a few times. But it seems to me that Batman's rules are very much like Star Trek's Prime Directive, where it's there, but no one really follows it, because the other one is Batman doesn't kill, but he doesn't kill by direct action in those films, but he'll kill by omission of action. So it's kind of wishy-washy to me.
Yes, it's absolutely wishy-washy. I mean, I'm a hardcore Batman fan, and I'm all about what makes Batman Batman, but you're absolutely right. It's just how it is. I mean, and also, if you go back far enough in the comic books, he has used guns, and there's sporadic times when he's used guns to save himself or save other people, and there's other times when he kills people. And, like, I remember he hanged somebody from the Batplane one time, if you go back far enough in the comic books. And Superman has killed people in the comic books. I mean, it just, there's so many different lores, there's so many different rules that it depends on which Batman you're talking about.
We'll have to do a comic book movie episode, you know, what it's like to adapt comic books into films, but... You know, this is the problem that all the comic book purists seem to face, is that, you know, there's so many different rules and so many different adaptations that when you bring it to the screen, there's no way to please everybody. Everybody's going to be upset that because you didn't stick to one version of the comics or the rules or something like that.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that it's... You can call yourself a purist and you could say that Batman would never do that, and you could, and then the only way that you can combat that is say, which Batman? You know, like, you know, are we talking about, you know, the comic book Batman? Are we talking about the 60s Batman? Are we talking about Frank Miller's Batman? Burton's Batman? You know, I think I already said that. You know, like, Nolan's Batman? It just depends on which one you're talking about. And it's, you know, if this Batmobile wants to have guns, then more power to it. And I'm sure it'll be awesome. But speaking of superheroes... You know, not just in the DC universe, but let's transfer over to the Marvel universe. Now, you and I were talking all week and all weekend about how you've been having certain woes.
Yes. Well, for Batman to you is what currently Captain America is to me in the Marvel verse, and for more than one reason. I think with this last movie, The Winter Soldier, his story became a lot more interesting to me, and he's a lot more layered, and it doesn't hurt the fact that he's played by Chris Evans. But anyway, so I had pre-ordered the Best Buy exclusive Steelbook Collector's Edition of the movie, which is supposed to be coming out this last Tuesday. And I was told that I would receive it within, you know, maybe a day or two of the actual release. Well, it was released on Tuesday. I had heard not anything from it until Saturday. Yesterday is when I finally got it into my hands. And, you know... I will never order from Best Buy again.
Okay, see, here's the thing, is that when you just talk about that in normal conversation, non-nerds would be like, oh, boo-hoo, these are first-world problems.
Yeah.
And yeah, they are. Most of the stuff that you and I complain about in our lives are first-world problems.
I'm very well aware of how ashamed I should be that this is the worst thing that happened to me this week.
But the thing is, though, okay, I'm glad that you understand that, but the thing is, as nerds, as geeks, this is a big deal. Like, we want our media, and we want it our way, and we want it now. And when we pre-order something, we want it the day that it comes out so that we get those special editions, so we get those special features, and we want to enjoy it with the rest of the world on the day that it's released, because your friends, your family, who are fellow geeks and nerds, are going to be doing it on that day. And when it doesn't show up, it's sad.
Yeah, everybody else was posting that they were watching it, and I was like, I wish I was watching it right now. And then I kept getting emails from Best Buy in the middle of the week saying, review the item you just bought. And I was like, I would love to, except that I can't.
Yeah, Best Buy is pissing me off more and more every single time I go there or talk about them. Like, just the other day, I had an email from them where it said, oh, you know, like, happy anniversary. Thank you for being a card member for 6 years. And here's your anniversary present, and get these special savings. And so I click on the button. It just takes me to the homepage. It takes me to the homepage where it's the normal savings or whatever, the quote-unquote savings that you get every single day that every
Pretty
customer
much.
Can get.
Yeah.
And I'm so pissed off.
The only thing that I like about them is that they do have a good warranty program through their Geek Squad. I always get my computer fixed on time with no charge and reasonable prices. So
Well, that's nice.
That's the one thing I could say positively about them. But in the meantime of having to go through Captain America withdrawals, I told you this on Twitter this week, Tristan, but I've just been binge watching The Blacklist on Netflix because they just added it last Sunday. And the only reason I'm bringing this up now is because it's kind of Marvel research in a sense that this is James Spader's new show, and he's going to be Ultron next year in Avengers 2. So, you know, I wanted to get more familiar with his recent work because I haven't seen a lot of his stuff. The last thing I saw him in was Stargate, the movie, back in 94 when he was playing this Weasley little mousy scientist, mm-hmm. professorial type. And I'm like, well, everybody's saying he's such a good villain type, so I should probably watch him where he actually plays somewhat of a dark character, and that's what he is in The Blacklist. He's sort of a Hannibal Lecter-like figure, and the man is fantastic. He's got such a great voice, and it made me doubly excited for next year's movie.
He does have a fantastic voice, and the thing that I love him the most from would be Boston Legal with William Shatner. And that is, I wrote my dissertation on his character and his closing arguments because they were so fantastic. And it's you need to give it a shot. I don't know if it's on Netflix. I don't think it is.
No, but the DVD seasons right now are actually really cheap, so I might give it a shot.
They are really cheap, and if you want, like, just buy season one and you'll be hooked, because he, like, William Shatner is amazing. Like, he is hilarious, and it's well acted, and the relationship between James Spader and William Shatner is what makes the show. And there's not one weak season.
It's got a dynamite cast. I mean, besides Spader and Shatner, I like Candice Bergen, mm-hmm. Renee Bergenois, Betty White is in there for every now and then, you know, so it's kind mm-hmm. of tailor-made for me, so I will be seeing it at some point.
There's also Renee Bergenois is in it, as you said, but Armin Shimerman makes a guest appearance.
Yes, I've heard that, yeah.
And they share a scene together, and you just start geeking out so hard when you watch it.
Plus, I heard Shatner does, they have his character do a lot of Star Trek references within the show.
There are a lot of Star Trek references, and they break the fourth wall a lot, yeah. Which is a lot of fun. I always think that's fun.
So I'll be tracking it down, but that was sort of our week in superhero news that piqued our interest.
Definitely, and I'm sure a lot of you have been going through the same woes with Best Buy's pre-ordering or even Amazon's pre-ordering. But before we dwell on that too terribly much, let's go ahead and go into the topic for this week. And as we said at the top of the show, it's remakes. Now, Matt, there's not just remakes, am I right? There's different versions that cinema likes to use in order to delineate and categorize its new movies, or quote-unquote new movies.
Well, much like the five stages of grief, we've gone through the three stages of remake. So, I like to classify this as the 90s and prior. Whenever a work of a previous film was done again in a new way, that was called a remake. It would be updated for the modern age. It would be pretty much the same story with maybe one or two tweaks to the actual plot, but it would be essentially the same movie. So, would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Right. So then we started to, at the turn of the century, remake became a naughty word because a lot of the remakes weren't as satisfying as the originals, and rightly so. We're going to talk about a couple of them that weren't. But we weren't quite into the third stage of the remake phase, which is now what we have today, which we call the reboot, where it's not really a remake. It's restarting something that had either stopped or had failed a long time ago, and we're seeing if we can do something new with it. So that's where we are now. Then there was this weird transitional phase in the 90s where the term reboot for movies hadn't been invented yet, and remake was such an ugly word with such negative connotations that we started to put this new spin on it when we called new things, quote-unquote, reimaginings. Do you remember this phase?
I remember this phase very, very well. Reimagining, that's right. And it was in the 90s and even bled into the early 2000s.
Yes, but it was very late 90s. I would say circa 99 is when we started this reimagining sort of deal.
So we can call it turn of the century. And, okay, so I'd say that the movie that I remember being the poster child for reimagining was Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton version.
Had talked about in our previous episode, but yes. Because, like I said, because the word remake was such an ugly word at the time that they dare not call it a remake, especially since they took really, in that movie in particular, so many liberties with the old story.
Yes, very much. And I remember an interview with Mark Wahlberg where he said, like, somebody said, like, so this is a remake. And he goes, hey, it's not a remake. It's not a remake. It's a reimagining. This is a Tim Burton spin. This is a Burton movie now, you know? And so it's just like, everyone was just like, well, no, not a remake. And
oh, it sure as hell was a Tim Burton movie. That's for sure.
I miss 90s Tim Burton so bad. 80s and 90s.
Really, Planet of the Apes, his version, was where he turned.
Yeah, I'd say that was kind of the tipping point. That was where we reached the point of no return.
And you know what? It just so happens it's also the same time he met Helena Bonham Carter, so maybe she's his albatross.
I refuse to believe that, and you take that back right now.
What? She plays the same character in every movie.
Oh, man. I wish we lived in the same town, because I'd slap you for that one.
She's always a little bit weird. She might be a druggie. You know,
I have two framed photos of Helena Bonham Carter hanging on my wall right now.
So what you're saying is you're into weird.
I am into weird people. I married one. And she'd be the first one to agree with that. Now, okay, so now that you've described the differences, the three categories of remakes or whatnot, one thing that I'd like to talk about is, before we get into the good ones and the bad ones, I'd like to talk about Star Trek 09. Now, I know that we don't like to talk about Star Trek too terribly much on this podcast, because you and I both come from Star Trek podcasts, and this one is General Geek, but...
And we also, just a side note, we didn't want to talk about these new series of films, not because we don't have interesting things to say about them, just because, and you or I were talking about this earlier this week, Tristan, there's so much contention around these two new films that, quite frankly, I'm a big fan of the two new films. I know you like the first one and not so much the second, but it's just gotten to the point where, you know, I've gotten so much abuse thrown at me online that it's no longer fun to talk about. So
that's the sad part. And like you said, we were talking about how, and I have my criticisms of J.J. Abrams and the Abrams verse and everything like that. But the thing is that I'm just happy that Star Trek's on the air, but I'm just happy that Star Trek is in the cinemas and that it's alive and well and that people are watching it and liking
it. Not only that, but back in the mainstream, which it desperately needed to be, in my opinion.
Absolutely, it needed to be back in the mainstream. These movies are the only reason why we might actually see a TV show on the horizon. That's the only reason why. If these movies didn't happen, Star Trek would have died. I'm sorry, that's just how it is. Like, yeah, we would have had the fan films, but that would have just been the, you know, preaching to the converted already. So
right.
It's just it's sad that there's so much negativity around it, and I'll make my jokes, you know, like I said I'll criticize it here and there, but I'm never going to criticize somebody else for liking it. That's just piss poor.
Right. And I agree, but that I'll get off my soapbox now, but just wanted to explain to the listeners we may not do a show on one of those, not because we don't want to, just because, you know, we've said all that needs to be said, and it's just, for me, it's just not fun anymore. I still love the films, but you know,
yeah,
talking
and
that's
a sad state to be in. Think about that, Star Trek fans who are listening. That's a sad state to be in, that a Star Trek fan has been bullied so much that he doesn't want to talk about Star Trek anymore by other Star Trek fans. Let that sink in for a little bit. But let's talk about Star Trek 09. So we have remake, reboot, and reimagining.
It's a reboot. For sure. That's the first one that I associated with the term reboot. Now, it had been thrown around before, but to me, that's a reboot.
So reboot is the first thing that comes to mind for you. And actually, there was a term that I forgot that about 2009, Star Trek 2009, and it wasn't reimagining, it was sequel. So reboot, remake, and sequel. And so those are the three things that I think you could call this. And you automatically go with reboot. And I think that there's a case to make for all three.
I think it could be a C-boot.
A C-boot? 2020? Okay, so here's my case. Now, reboot is obvious. It's different set of actors. The style is different. CGI is different. And it's, you know, history is different.
Reboot, to me, has the connotation of, we did this in the past, and whatever its last incarnation was, didn't work. So we're trying it again. We're rebooting it, like rebooting a dead PC sort of thing.
Yeah, and with a reboot, you disregard the history or the timeline before. You act like the others didn't happen.
But that was kind of unique with this one, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah, and it's very unique, and I think so that definitely qualifies for the rules because it creates an alternate reality, you know, where they can disregard the history. Vulcan's gone, you know, the Kelvin was destroyed or whatever, like Kirk's dad died, blah blah blah, and so all that stuff happened. And then for remake, I think you could argue because it's, how do I put it as remake? Like I feel like you could argue it with a remake because it almost has the blessings of the older crew, where it's the same, like you have the same type of story where it's Kirk and Spock on the bridge and they're going through and they're traveling through space, you know?
I kind of see what you're getting at too, because one of the things with the 90s remakes is, you know what one of their tropes would be usually? They would usually get a token actor from the original version of whatever they're remaking to put them in the new movie somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be like, you know, Gregory Peck and Robert Mitchum are in the Cape Fear remake as different people. But, you know, they would grab some of the old stars and put them in the new one and say, see, look, we have their blessing.
And see, that's the thing, is that you don't call Cape Fear a reboot, even though it disregards the previous one and takes a different spin on it. But, I mean, and with remake, it's just, I feel like Star Trek Into Darkness has a better chance of being called a remake because of the whole Wrath of Khan stuff.
Yeah.
That's a whole new can of worms.
Yeah, you're getting into touchy territory with me there.
But I'll move off from, like, I feel like reboot and remake can be kind of interchangeable depending on which facts you focus on. But the reason why I think it could be all three and the sequel being the third is because we start in the prime timeline.
Yeah, the Spock that comes back, Leonard Nimoy Spock, is Spock from post-Star Trek Nemesis.
That's right. So this movie started with post-Nemesis beings and people and storyline coming into the new Abramsverse. And thus, everything that follows is post-Nemesis, just in a different timeline, thrown back in time. And thus, it could be considered a sequel to Nemesis. Am I wrong? Could be.
No, it's very weird. Like, Star Trek 2009 was kind of one of those I still consider it a reboot, but it kind of defied labels.
Yes.
Because it took elements from every single one of these things that you're talking about. And for once, it doesn't go full reboot because the prime timeline is still there. It's still continuing. This is an offshoot. We're going to really Star Trek geek out now, but this is just like the TNG episode Parallels. This is what I always tell Star Trek fans who are so upset about the new Abramsverse destroying Prime Line, that no, it's just like when Worf was shifting in between realities. This is just one of those other quantum realities.
It's nothing new. This has been done all the time throughout Star Trek, and it doesn't mean like if I take out my TNG DVDs that they're going to be blank. No, it's just an alternate universe and an alternate time. They even say it in the movie. They say it in the freaking movie. Uhura says it out loud.
They want you to be perfectly clear. We're not destroying your old timeline. This is a different timeline. Okay, Trekkies? See, we're being good to you. You know, for all we know, one of the 185,000 Enterprise Ds that show up in that episode, maybe one of them is the Abramsverse Enterprise D.
That would be pretty badass, and I definitely want to see that. So that's my case for saying that it could be all three. And I got into a really heated argument with some jerk online who was just so angry that I said that it could be one of all three. He was just so angry with me that I had to block him because he started being abusive. But I was just like, wow, where is this coming from? People get so touchy about this stuff.
I'm telling you, it's vitriolic. That's why I don't like talking about these films anymore. It's just because people are way overreacting to the point where, like, it's okay. It's like we all love Star Trek, but it's just fiction. It's not real.
It's so true. I hate to say that too, because I hate to admit that it's not real. But yeah. But before we attract more vicious people and they attack us and hijack the podcast, let's move on into a different category. Let's talk about some of our favorite remakes and some of our least favorite remakes. Now, which one do you want to tackle first? Do you want to tackle the good stuff or the bad stuff first?
Well, let's hit the good stuff. We're a podcast that focuses on positivity. Now, unfortunately, we're going to get into some of the bad remakes, and I got a lot to say, but I'll try not to get too pessimistic because there is some good stuff out there.
Now, what we'll do is that, because I have a big list, so I'll just throw out a few, and then you can throw out a few. So, some of my favorites are, and I know that, like, movie taste is just that. It's your personal taste, you know? And some of my favorites are Man on Fire, The Mummy, Enemy Mine and The Birdcage.
Right.
Now, Man on Fire was based off of a Scott Glenn film in 1987. The Mummy was obviously based off of the 1932 iconic film. Enemy Mine was based off of Hell in the Pacific in 1968. And The Birdcage was, well, I mean, The Birdcage is kind of it was a play.
It was a French film too, La Cage aux Folles.
Yeah, and in 1973. Excuse me, the play was in 1973, the film was in 1975, and then The Birdcage was in 1996. And so those are some of my favorites. Now, I have a lot more on the list, but I thought we could talk about those real quick. Are you familiar with all of those? None of them? Well, I know you're familiar with The Birdcage.
The Birdcage I'm familiar with. Man on Fire I saw a long time ago. The Mummy I saw a long time ago, but I remember liking. What was the fourth one again?
Enemy Mine. Not too many people know about that movie.
No, I've heard of the movie, but I've not seen it.
It was made in 1985, and it stars Louis Gossett Jr. and Dennis Quaid. Ooh. And the cool thing about Hell in the Pacific is that it takes place on an island in the Pacific, about two people who are different ideologies and want to kill each other. And Enemy Mine is the same story, but with a sci-fi stint, where it's the human race is at war with an alien race, and they crash land on a planet, and they spend something like, I can't remember, it's something like 10 years together on this planet trying to survive, and they grow to love each other and appreciate one another's cultures and overcome their differences. And it's a really good movie. Like it's gets kind of sad, it can get kind of scary, but it really has a powerful, powerful message, and it doesn't get a lot of love.
Yeah, I was going to say, it probably doesn't get a lot of love because I've not heard good things about Louis Gossett Jr. movies post Officer and a Gentleman.
Oh, come on. You're like, Iron Eagle? You don't love Iron Eagle?
I wouldn't call it a good film. I mean, I like it, but I wouldn't call it a good film.
Yeah, I guess I could give you that. I mean, he made four of them. Holy crap. But so,
I mean, I laugh at Arnold's Commando, but I would never call that a good film. It's just a guilty pleasure film.
Yeah, see, and that's the thing, as we go further down on this list of some of my favorites, and your favorites, I mean, I'm sure there's certain ones where I just go, I can't defend this, I just love it.
Right.
So give me some of yours.
Well, I have three that I really love, and there are ones that, okay, I'll just throw this out up front. In addition to being a sci-fi and comic book fan, Tristan, you know I'm a big horror fan, and it just seems like horror movies lately have been the target of the remake, reboot, whatever you want to call it, phenomenon. So there's a lot of remakes that I've seen. But there are three in particular that I really love, and I'm curious to know if you have seen any of them. The first one that I always put as like one of the best remakes or redos of a film ever is John Carpenter's 1982 movie The Thing, which is a remake of a classic 1951 movie called The Thing from Another World. And it's a small little thing. It wasn't successful at the time because, funny story, it came out the same year as E.T. And back then, people didn't want unfriendly alien movies. And The Thing is really an unfriendly alien movie. But it just got such an atmosphere. It's got a great cast. It's got a wonderful sense of paranoia because The Thing is a shapeshifter. It's fantastic. I really like that movie a lot. Second horror one that I actually really like is one that I think is kind of underrated, quite frankly, and that is Red Dragon from 2002.
I love that movie.
Yeah, I like it too. And it is it's an adaptation necessarily of Thomas Harris's novel Red Dragon. No, it's Red Dragon. The book itself is called Red Dragon. It was originally adapted for the screen in 1986 when it was called Manhunter.
That's right.
But 2002 Red Dragon is when you get Anthony Hopkins back in the Hannibal Lecter role and Edward Norton, Ralph Fiennes. I think it's just got a great cast. Yes, I realize it's Brett Ratner and he's not necessarily a great director, but you know, I thought it was a very solid movie. I really like that version.
That's the word that I was going to use. Like, if you don't like him as a director, it's hard not to like him in this because it's solid filmmaking, solid cinematography, writing, storytelling, visuals. It's textbook stuff.
It is textbook stuff, and that could be a criticism, but I also see it as a positive because, you know, especially considering the Hannibal Lecter series itself, I liked So Red Dragon was the third one. I liked the second one, Hannibal from 2001, but that was a very bizarre movie.
Yeah.
It's very, very bizarre. It's very, very off the cuff. Red Dragon feels like they're trying to go back to Silence of the Lambs, which I appreciated.
Yes, I felt like Red Dragon was kind of an apology for Hannibal. I mean, even those who liked it, which I liked it more the second time I saw it, because the first time I saw it, I wanted to throw something at the screen.
It's bizarre. It's bizarre. Like, that's a movie that requires a couple of watchings to know how you feel about it. But I liked it, but I really liked going back to Silence of the Lambs-esque. He's back in the cage. They recreated the sets. They got the a-hole psychologist back from the original movie. You know, it was a nice atmospheric return to that film, which I appreciated.
And that's also brings in another word that it could be qualified as, and that's a prequel.
It is a prequel. It is a prequel, but I threw it in with remakes because it had already been tried before once with Manhunter.
Yes, absolutely. No, I would qualify that as a remake first and a prequel second. And that's the thing, is that people who are listening, you can have different categories for these films. I mean, you can use more than one word. It's not one or the other. It can be both.
The third one, and I'm sure no one has seen this film because it's very, very underrated. I'm not even sure most people exist. And that's the 1990 version of Night of the Living Dead. Hmm. And that it's a remake of the Romero film from the 60s, which, again, is a fantastic film. I'm not going to say that that's a bad film by any stretch of the imagination, but horror effects artist Tom Savini directed this 1990 version, and it's got Tony Todd as the lead. I just kind of liked what they did updating the story a little bit. Specifically, I'm one that likes strong female characters, and the female characters, they were present in the 68 version, but the main one kind of gets attacked at the beginning and just sits and cries for the rest of the film. In the 1990 version, she gets attacked in the beginning and meets up with Tony Todd, and they're all barricaded inside the house, but she's wielding the shotgun and she's defending herself. And I kind of liked the way it was updated. So I would never call it a great film, but I think it's a well enough adaptation. So I do appreciate that version a lot.
Yeah. I haven't seen either of those. I mean, of the two of us, you are much more the horror fan, and I think I need to take your list and put it in my queue, because I feel like you could make me a good list of things I need to watch.
If you have not seen The Thing, you must see The Thing. It is one of the best sci-fi horror movies next to Alien, in my opinion.
Well, then I'll definitely watch it then, because I haven't seen it, and it's one of those movies that I'm kind of ashamed that I haven't seen. That I won't admit it at a party if I haven't seen it. One of those movies, you know, we all have those movies that we don't admit that we haven't seen.
And plus, it's got like a nice list of B action guys from the 80s, because it's one of Kurt Russell's first films. You got, I would never call him an action guy, but it's got Wilford Brimley in it, who was a nice presence in the film. It's got Keith David, the nice, really intimidating guy from so many other films. I mean, it's just fantastic. I love that film. I think you would like it, Tristan. I really do. Right.
Well, I'll definitely give it a try. With my next ones, I have a couple more, and I think you like this one too, and that's True Lies.
Yes, and you know, you mentioned this before when we were talking off air previously, and I had no idea it was a remake of something.
Yeah, it was a French film, La Totale, in 1991, and it's basically the same plot. It's very, very similar, but, you know, it's you know, James Cameron got a hold of it, so it's a way bigger budget, way more action, but it has the same kind of feeling, and, you know, just Arnold and Jamie Lee Curtis just make it their own, and it's just, I love that movie. It's just, it's so much fun. They have such great one-liners, a lot of great action, and it's like the only Tom Arnold movie that I actually like, and it's, you know, I'm a big sucker for James Cameron, and we've talked about James Cameron a lot.
Yeah, I mean, say what you will about the man, and yes, the dialogue that he writes is sometimes simplistic, and so are the stories, but the man knows what I like in cinema.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, God love him.
And then there's Heat, which...
Ooh, the Michael Mann movie?
The Michael Mann movie. It is, and here's the thing, is that it's a remake of Michael Mann's own work in 1989. He made a TV movie which was the same plot, same name. And it's in the 1995 version, he kind of got rid of some of the subplots that didn't matter and up the action and up the performances. And it's a much more of a modern day epic, crime epic, than it was in the TV movie. And I freaking love Heat. It's in my opinion, an ultimate guy movie. Now, I'm not saying that because women can enjoy it. I'm not trying to be sexist. I'm just saying it's an ultimate guy movie, as in every guy, and I can't speak for women because I'm not a woman, but every guy has imagined what it would be like to be in a heist.
Yes.
Every guy has that moment, has that fantasy. And I'm a law-abiding citizen. You know, like, I don't jaywalk, okay? But I have had fantasies of me being in a bank heist, like in Heat.
There's just something about a good heist movie that's fun. You know, like, you would never do that in real life, but it's just fun to watch carry out and watch it hit its snags and turns. And yeah, I'm with you. Heat is a great movie. And it brings up something very interesting, because I did not know that it was based on something that Michael Mann had directed previously. And that doesn't happen very often, where the same director will try again and remake their own work. I mean, the only other example that I can think of is when Hitchcock remade The Man Who Knew Too Much the second time. He had made it originally in the 30s and was not satisfied with that version, so he went again and made it in the 50s, which is the version that we know today.
I have another version, but I'm going to save that for the very last, for my ultimate remake of all time that I love, and that is one of the best movies of all time, where a director did that. But before I get to that one, I want to get to Ben-Hur, which is 1959 with Chuck Heston, is just an
you
amazing
love your
movie.
Chuck Heston.
I love Chuck Heston so very, very much, and no one can convince me otherwise. I love his voice. I love how he looks. I love his acting. I love the persona that he portrays on screen. Everything about him on screen, I just think is fantastic. And it was originally a 1923 silent film, and excuse me, 1925. And it was William Wyler, who's the director of the 50s version, was an assistant director on the silent film. And I never knew that. I just thought that was such a great connection. And the chariot race is almost a shot-for-shot recreation. And it's both are amazing, but the 59 version just brings it to a whole nother level. And the second-to-last one that I'm going to talk about is The Departed.
Again, did not know that was a remake.
Yes, it is a remake, and not a lot of people know that. And it's it was made in 2006 by Martin Scorsese, and it's based off of a movie called Internal Affairs that was made in 2003, which was made in Hong Kong. And this is just another continuation of the proud tradition of Americans remaking movies that were made overseas in Asia, and mainly it's horror movies that get remade that originate in Asia. But this one is not a horror film; it's a crime saga. And The Departed is Internal Affairs. I'm sad to say I've never seen it, and I'm very sad that I haven't seen it. And I'm going to rectify it as soon as possible, because I love Departed so much. I have a poster of it on my wall at work. That's how much I love it. And so that way everybody knows when they walk by my office that I love this movie. And it's a fantastic film. And I'm sure there's people out there screaming at their iPods and at their cars, car radios, that are saying, oh, the original's so much better. But that's the thing, is that we're not making this list of saying that these are remakes that are better than the originals. We're saying that these are remakes that we absolutely love and that we think worked. And The Departed in 2006 is just mind-blowing. It's Martin Scorsese at his best. Leonardo DiCaprio, Matt Damon, Jack Nicholson, these are my absolute favorite roles of theirs.
And you know what? I think it does what remake's job should do, is that you just said that you want to see Internal Affairs right away, or as soon as possible, right?
Yes.
I think any good reboot or remake would if it's done right, will generate enough interest that people would want to go back and check out the original.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it may come to it where I'm like, wow, this is even better than The Departed, and that's fantastic, and I'm open to that happening. Do I think that's going to happen? No, because I love it so much, but I'm definitely open to it. And I'm not going to give my favorite one, because I want to hear more of yours. I want to quit talking for a while.
Well, I mean, we're going to start devolving into more horror stuff because, like I said, that's just where the remake genre is. Now, I can give you one that kind of was in between for me. It was a one where I disliked it for a long time and I eventually came around to it, but reluctantly. My favorite horror movie of all time, and I hope to God we do an episode on it someday, is Halloween. 1978, John Carpenter, Jamie Lee Curtis's first film. I saw that when I was 14, and I have been in love with slasher movies ever since. It was just the perfect, simplistic, bloodless, surprisingly. It's all suspense. There's no violence to be said. It's all theater of the mind sort of things. Very, very Hitchcockian that way.
I didn't know that.
I take it then you have not seen the original version.
No, I haven't seen it because I just don't like horror films because I don't like gore. But the thing is, I love what horror used to be, and that's suspense.
There's no gore. You may see a streak of blood every now and then, but that's it. It's all music. It's all camera work. It's shadows. It's fantastic, and you watch that in a dark room with the sound turned up, and you're gonna have a good time. So. I was excited in the early 2000s when I heard that I was cautiously excited. Let me rephrase that. When I heard that there was going to be a Halloween remake or reboot, because it was kind of in that weird in between phase. It was 2007. Mm-hmm. So I was excited, cautiously so, but excited because the previous film was so terrible that there was just no conceivable way of continuing from that film. So I was like, okay, we'll go back and we'll see what we can do with Halloween these days and see if we can make it another interesting ride. And well, it was interesting. It was definitely not what I was used to as far as Halloween was concerned, because this was made by Rob Zombie, who is very famous for not only being a like hardcore rock musician, but had done a couple of films previously to Halloween that were very off kilter and very strange. And The remake is very, very tonally different. It's more violent. It's much more graphic. I'm no prude to explicit language. I mean, I keep it family friendly on this show, but I'm certainly no prude to it. I use it every day in my life. But, you know, I got pushed to a point where every other word is the F word, that makes it just kind of overly gratuitous to me.
It can be distracting as well.
Yeah, it's distracting and it's just off-putting and... I don't know. There were stylistic choices that I didn't really agree with. The Jamie Lee Curtis character from the first movie is supposed to be the girl next door sort of type. And while that might be cliche, it's somebody that you can understand and it's somebody that you can get behind and root for. In this new version, she's kind of a smart aleck, which, you know, I'm a smart aleck too, so I can identify with that. But it was taken to the point where it no longer feels like the character. The essence of the character doesn't feel like it's there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. They just went some weird twists and turns with it that I walked out that first night from seeing it just kind of disappointed. It wasn't really what I wanted. On subsequent viewing, I was able to come around to it, and now I would call myself a reluctant fan of the remake, but... It was one that left, in my opinion, a lot to be desired. And then when they made the sequel to it a couple years later, it just completely ruined that remake verse. So we're back to square one at this point. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of one I feel in between on.
Okay,
so,
well, what would you say is your absolute favorite remake of all time?
If I had to pick one from the list, it would be the one that I already mentioned, which is The Thing. I think that's
The Thing.
The best remake of all time. For me.
Well, the one for me, which I haven't given yet, and which is my absolute favorite remake of all time, and if not one of the greatest films ever made, and that is, and you're going to laugh at me, is The Ten Commandments with Chuck Heston.
Of course.
This movie is fantastic. This was my favorite movie when I was five, and it's one of my favorite movies today. It is what is... truly deserves the word epic. This is an epic. Now, we use it all the time. We use that word all the time today. Like, we're like, oh, this cheeseburger was epic. No, it was not. Do you know what was epic? The Ten Commandments. That was epic.
From five to today. So that means that it lasted that long, because the Ten Commandments is about 7 years long.
Yeah, I've only been able to watch it twice in my life because it's that long. No, it's okay. So the story behind that is Ten Commandments, the Chuck Heston version, came out in 1956, but it was originally a silent film in 1923, both directed by Cecil B. DeMille.
Huh, okay.
And so that's what I was talking about earlier, about how you said you don't see that very often, and you don't. And this is one of the greatest films ever made. And it's this Yul Brynner as Ramses. Come on, that's amazing. And I just, this movie, this is the epitome of what a man should be like. And that is Chuck Heston when he's Moses. And I just, I love this movie so much. I watch it at least once a year. And yeah, so it's technically a remake because it was Cecil B. DeMille's first work. Not first work, but it was originally in 1923.
That needs to be on the back of the DVD. Chuck Heston is essentially everything a man could be. Tristan Riddell, the Nerd Party.
There you go. Quoted by Tristan Riddell and the Nerd Party. That's on the back of my DVD. But yeah, there was a special edition of Ten Commandments on DVD, which I, of course, have. And it comes with the original 1923 version on DVD, and it's something to see. It's very different. The two versions are very different. But yeah, that's my favorite. Now as we don't have a lot of time left, but as we transition into things that didn't quite work or remakes that weren't that great, there are two movies that I want to get your opinion on. And okay. These are two movies that I absolutely love and that are remakes, but the world hates them. And I didn't know that the world hated them until I became a member of the online community. And those two movies are Vanilla Sky and City of Angels.
Vanilla Sky's a weird one. Like, I didn't know that was a remake.
Yes, it was it's a remake of a Spanish film, a Spanish language film in 1997 called Abre los Ojos, which means open your eyes, which is a very common phrase in Vanilla Sky. And it's basically the same plot, but just a few things are a little bit different. Like, it's Cameron Crowe style, so things are much more stylistic, much more artsy. And I've seen the original, and I love this one by leaps and bounds over the original. And I like Tom Cruise. I love Penelope Cruz, and Kurt Russell's in it. And Cameron Crowe films, I think, on as a whole, are pretty good, generally speaking, on average. But yeah, people hate this movie.
They do. I do remember there was a lot of vitriol around it at the time it came out. I haven't seen it in forever. I do remember thinking it is very, you say artsy, like when directors go artsy, it just, you know, when you say artsy, the first thing that comes to my mind is Kubrick. I remember thinking it was like very Kubrickian.
Well, I think a lot of people would hate that you compared this movie to a Kubrick film, but I'd have to agree with you that it's very stylistic. It's the color palette is amazing. The music is fantastic. And I think the direction's well, and the acting is spot on. And it's Cameron Diaz is in it. I can't stand Cameron Diaz, but I like her character in this movie because you're not supposed to like her character. And it just totally fits. And I have yet to have somebody properly explain to me why this was a bad film.
Yeah, well, I can't explain to you why it was a bad film because I don't really remember it. I've not seen the other one that you mentioned either.
It's not very good. Penelope Cruz plays the same character in both.
Oh, that's what it is. You just like Penelope Cruz.
I do like Penelope Cruz, but I didn't like the original. I didn't like it at all. And the other one, like I said, is City of Angels, which
I have not seen this one.
Oh, you haven't seen this one? Okay, no. Well, we can't really talk about it too much, but it's a 1998 film, and it's based off of a 1987 German film, Wings of Desire, and Peter Falk is actually in it.
Columbo?
Yeah, the guy who played Columbo. And I saw Wings of Desire, and I wrote a report on it, had to analyze it for school, in film school, and I hated this movie. I hated Wings of Desire. I thought, this is a piece of crap. This is boring, this is mundane, this is drab. I was like, oh, why do people like this movie?
And then it was probably a good film because you dislike good things, Tristan. We've established this in previous private conversations.
That is harsh.
Stop disliking good things.
I love good things. I love good things. But the thing is, I also love things that aren't heralded as good things. I think that's where you're getting caught up. And City of Angels has a much different tone. Much different tone than Wings of Desire, where City of Angels is much more ethereal and is much more melodramatic. It's very melodramatic. And I think that's why people don't like it, is because it is a little bit over the top with its breathy sense of oh no, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't know, I just I thought it was Nick Cage in one of his better roles, and it's before Meg Ryan kind of went off the deep end. And I like it. I mean, I'm sure I'm gonna get a lot of hate online for people who can't stand Vanilla Sky in City of Angels, and I respect that. If you don't like it, you don't like it, but give me a good reason why you don't like it.
They'll just do the opposite of what I just told you. They'll say stop liking bad things.
Stop liking bad things. I do like some bad things, but I love good things, and you shut up about that. Now, okay, we don't have a lot of time left, so give me some of those that you're iffy about, or you can just go straight into a list of remakes that you think didn't quite work.
Well, the list of remakes that don't work are endless, but let's talk about beyond not working. Let's talk about movies that waste time.
There you go. I think that's good.
Because the thing that I respect about remakes that don't work is that they try to put their own spin on it, so it doesn't feel like you're watching the same movie again. You know what I mean? Because if I wanted to watch the same movie again, let's just go watch the original. I don't need the remake. So let's talk about the time where we actually did watch the same movie again. Let's talk about 1998's version of Psycho.
Yes, that is on my list.
Let's talk about that film, because the point of that film originally is that they felt that the Alfred Hitchcock work needed to be updated, quote unquote, for the modern age. And I guess what they meant by updated was put it in color, because that's about the only thing that's different about this new film. Pretty much line, except for a few, you know, and I only know this because I'm so familiar with the old version, but except for a few line changes to update it to 1998 standards, it's the same dialogue, it's the same camera work, it's the same pretty much everything, with a few minor stylistic changes that don't work. The things that they did change don't work. So, exactly.
Yeah, and there's, of course, the masturbation scene that was added in.
Yeah.
Unnecessarily so. Yeah, that's the thing. Okay, the thing that made Psycho so great, and it's not even one of my favorite films, and I don't even enjoy watching it that much, but the thing is, as a
former Stop disliking film, good things!
Shut up! I was just about to defend it. As a former film student, I recognize what makes it great. I recognize what makes it great, and I appreciate for what it is. It's just not my cup of tea. There's a difference. And see, the thing is about that film is that it was groundbreaking when it came out in 1960. It was absolutely, positively groundbreaking with the acting, the directing, the cinematography, the special effects. All of it was just amazing for 1960. The thing is when you make a shot-for-shot remake from the 1960s that was groundbreaking and then put it in 1998, it's no longer groundbreaking anymore.
Well, it was groundbreaking in the sense that I can't think of any other movie before or since that has done the shot-for-shot remake. It was an experiment in that. But like I said, it just reeked of, well, you know, if you're going to do it, why put so much money into doing the same film again?
Yeah.
You know, why waste everybody's time? And why miscast it? That movie suffers from such horrible miscasting. That was one of the biggest problems I had.
And I like the people in it. That's the thing. It's like,
I do too. I'm a fan of you know, people like Viggo Mortensen and Julianne Moore, and even Vince Vaughn to an extent.
Yeah, I'm a fan of all those people, but it just, they're, like you said, they were just miscast, and it was horrible. Now this is one. There's another one that I want to talk to you about where you actually liked the film and I didn't, and that's Insomnia, 2002's Insomnia.
Oh well, I actually just saw this because we did our Robin Williams show and everyone was telling me how good Insomnia was, and I thought I'd check it out. I'm not the biggest Nolan worshiper, and I know you've built an altar to him, Tristan. So
almost literally.
So it surprised me to learn that you weren't the biggest fan of this movie. I thought it was the one Nolan movie where I could like get behind 100%.
I think that's why I don't like it. I think that's I think it's because it's definitely a different kind of Nolan film. It's separate from what you would think is a Nolan film. Like if you watch this, I don't think you'd be, like, if you didn't know who directed it and you just tried to guess, I would never guess Christopher Nolan. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm not saying that's a bad thing at all. It's just for me, it just didn't connect. I thought it was boring. I thought it was drab. I thought the performances from Pacino were just kind of overwrought and a little weird. And I'm a big Pacino fan. And there are certain times I like my Robin Williams either with a beard and serious or jumping around and beardless and crazy. But I don't know. I don't know. I just didn't think it worked, but I'm definitely in the minority here.
Stop hating on good things.
You know, I could say the same thing about you.
I know you could, but you know, like I said,
like you don't like Memento.
I've not seen Memento in a long time. I want to revisit it.
Well, stop hating good things.
I just think that the Nolan as of late suffers from a lot of, and I've heard this term on other podcasts before, but to me it suffers from a lot of art house douchebaggery. Where it just feels like stylistic for the sake of being stylistic and not really serving plot or story.
You and I need to have a conversation about the comparative analysis of Christopher Nolan and the influence of Terrence Malick's work on his work.
Okay, film student.
We'll need to talk about that. All right, well, moving on. I'm just going to give a quick rundown, and we can talk about the ones that you want to talk about. Things that I did, remakes that I didn't like. And that's 3:10 to Yuma in 2007, Clash of the Titans in 2010, Pink Panther in 2006, The Lady Killers in 2004, and Scarface in 1983, and The Day the Earth Stood Still in 2008.
What is with Scarface? So like, there's just like this worship of this cult worship of this movie.
I don't understand it. I do not understand. There was a comedian who I think is John Mulaney. I think that's his name. And he was talking about how he was saying the same thing. He's like, I don't understand. I don't understand people who like Scarface. Like, I hear all the time. They're like, I like movies like The Godfather and Scarface. That's like saying, I like food like steak and Skittles. Something like that. And that's the thing, is that Scarface is such a crap movie, but it's worshipped by so many rappers.
It has elements that should work, right? I mean, Al Pacino is a good thing.
Michelle Pfeiffer is a good thing, too.
And Brian De Palma, the director, another mm-hmm. good thing.
Yeah.
So why, when you throw all those things in the mix, you don't get something that's very good? Like, it's one of those weird phenomena where, like, you see a movie that it has things that everything should be working for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it has everything going for it, but it is just complete, utter trash. And I've yet to find someone who likes it more than just the idea of Scarface.
That's what it must be, because like, especially on college campuses, the two big posters that sell everywhere are the Scarface poster and anything with Bob Marley in it.
So, yes, absolutely. I was listening to a podcast the other day. I was listening to Jay Moore's podcast, and he said that he had interaction with Megan Fox, and she has a Marilyn Monroe tattoo on her arm, and he's a big Joe DiMaggio fan, and he went up to her and he's like, oh man, I love your Marilyn Monroe tattoo. And this is so funny because I have a Joe DiMaggio tattoo. And he was just joking. And she goes, who's Joe DiMaggio? And
yeah,
I think that is the type of person who likes Scarface.
Yeah, well, Megan Fox, that beacon of intelligence.
All right. Well, okay. So what are some of the films that you dislike?
I mean, the list is endless. Psycho is definitely one of them. Halloween, like I said, is kind of in that in-between phase. You want me to really go through
just give me a handful. Like, I gave you gave you like seven, so give me some of those.
Black Christmas, that remake sucked. What else sucked? The Friday the 13th remake wasn't really, I think what the reboot wasn't really a reboot. It was kind of just like another film. So I don't think it sucked, but it got me wondering why even call that a remake or reboot of anything if it just felt like another sequel. Well, we talked about it already, but Planet of the Apes sucked. Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes sucked. I think those are the ones I feel vitriolic about. I actually have much more, if we ever do a show, I have a much more vitriolic hate of certain sequels to films.
Okay, yeah, we definitely need to do, yes, absolutely. We're definitely going to be doing a sequel show.
Real quick before we go, Tristan, we talked a lot about remakes that worked, remakes that didn't work. What's one thing that, you know, I'm usually pretty open to remakes, but what's one thing that you hope is never remade? Like, it shouldn't be touched.
Oh, man. Because I know what your movie is.
Yes.
And I agree with it wholeheartedly. But
let's talk about mine first and then give you a chance to think. Now, we had this conversation with a mutual friend of ours on Twitter a long, long time ago. But I'm of the opinion, because I'm sure it'll turn out either like Psycho or it'll be just a complete and utter train wreck, you cannot remake Steven Spielberg's Jaws. It just can't be done. I don't know how it could be done, and I think that if the temptation is there to do it, they'll make all the wrong stylistic choices. They won't get why that first film worked.
I think I like your choice because you're absolutely right. But at the same time, I feel like people would think they could do it.
That's the thing. I think people would take it as a challenge to themselves. But, you know, like I said, I don't trust people to make the same stylistic choices, which, you know, if you know anything about the making of the movie, weren't stylistic choices. They were by accident.
Mm-hmm. They were by necessity.
They were by necessity. So I feel like either they would make the wrong stylistic choice and try to do something completely different, or they would do the same stylistic choices, but it wouldn't feel like it was a necessity. It would feel like it's imitating.
I feel like we would just get Deep Blue Sea.
Which isn't a bad film, but it's not trying to be a Jaws remake.
Right, but I feel like that's what we would get. Yeah, I feel like you made a good choice because people would see it as a challenge. My choices, I feel like, are kind of safe choices where no one in their right mind would ever actually attempt to do it. And if they did try to attempt it, they would probably get assassinated, no joke. And the two films that pop into mind are Star Wars and The Godfather. I feel like if anyone tried to attempt to remake these, they would literally have assassination attempts. And I'm not saying that figuratively. I mean it literally. I think there are people out there crazy enough and hardcore fans enough that death threats would happen. And, you know, Star Wars is too perfect of a film, and The Godfather is hailed as one of the greatest films of all time. It's either one or two on whatever greatest movies of all time list you're looking at. And if you're looking at AFI, it's number two. If you're looking at BFI, it's number one. And there's a reason, because it's fantastic. And I don't think anyone could tackle it because no one has that type of ego.
Plus, save for a very select few, when have sequels to or remakes of Oscar-winning films ever worked?
Oh, I'd have to do some research on that one. I don't know. Like,
the one obvious one is Godfather 2.
Godfather 2, and then there's Empire Strikes Back, which some people say isn't a sequel because it's a part of a planned trilogy. But yeah, it's like I gave the two examples of where the sequels were better than the first, you know, and arguably.
I think we need to do a sequel show, Tristan. I think that's all that there is to it.
Yeah, we absolutely need to do a sequel show, and we will, because there's just so much to talk about with sequels. And I think we'd have much more disagreements about what's better and what's not, because you have with a remake and an original, it's pretty obvious which one's better and which one's worse. But with a sequel, I feel subjective. Like there's some it's much more subjective, and that could be a lot of fun to talk about. But until then, we have some business to take care of.
We do.
And that is, we have two customer reviews on the iTunes store that and we've said this on the podcast, and we've said this on Twitter. If you give us a 5-star review, we will give you a shout out on the podcast. And the first one on iTunes that was given to us is by SDC_SDC. And we just want to thank you for your 5-star review. And we have another one.
From Sequest Forever, who I believe just commented not too recently, very recently on the Delta Quadrant one. So I believe he's a Delta Quadrant listener. So thank you, Sequest Forever. I think I know who you are. But unless I don't want to end up with egg on my face, I'm not going to hazard a guess. But I think I know who you are. And if you are who you are, thank you.
And we invite all types of reviews. And if they're not 5 stars, or even if they're negative reviews, if you do give us a rating, please give us a review. And we want to know what works. We want to know what doesn't work. And also, like we said before, if you give us a 5-star review, we'll give you a shout out on the podcast. And also, please talk to us. Talk to us on Twitter and talk to us via email. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, these remakes, these are all subjective. We may have given some remakes that we absolutely hated that you love, and vice versa. Let us know which ones you like and dislike. Go to you can email us at contact@thenerdparty.com, or you can find me on Twitter at @TheInsaneRobin. Matt, where can we find you?
Yeah, you can find me at mhanson0207, HANSEN, where I'm sure a bunch of Trekkies are coming for me right now.
Well, if they got to go through me to get to you. But we thank you for listening all the same. I'm Tristan Riddell.
And I'm Matt Hansen.
Coming up next week.
Are you suggesting that someone's trying to make a real-life sequel?
Stab 2?
Who'd want to do that? Sequels suck.
No, wow.
Come on, man.
Oh, please, please. By definition alone, they're inferior films.
It's bullshit generalization. Many sequels have surpassed their original.
Oh, yeah?
Name one.
Yeah. Aliens. Far better than the first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's no accounting for taste.
Thank you, Ridley Scott rules. Name another.
I got it, by the way. I got it.
The Godfather, Part 2.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.